Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
Good morning and welcome to another episode of Atlanta Legal Experts. I am Emily and I've got Josh here chopping at the bit already.
It's Christmas time. I can't wait for the holidays to crank up. This is going to be a great holiday show.
And I was going to bring my Santa hat and I forgot.
Well, you know, man,
it would be great for the pictures.
We do have a lot of good dress-up times around here.
That's true. Scary too. That's true. So Josh Schiffer, you're actually my co-host again.
I love it.
So excited that you're here, and we've got a nice room of some great attorneys and great experts.
We've got a great show set up. We've got some really good bookings this morning. It covers kind of a broad spectrum of the law. We've got some family law practitioners that are going to sit down and talk about some interesting issues, including father's rights, which is something as we get to this season where we're really talking about how families come together. There's some really awkward junctures when you've got a family that's been fractured due to one issue or another. And we've got a great practitioner who's going to help with that. Sean Ditzel has been around here for a long time. He works for one of the preeminent firms in the state. We also have David Willingham, who's fantastic. He and I run into each other, actually, because we go to some of the same courts. David is a specialist in criminal law. He's here to talk about kind of the unfortunate side of the holidays.
Right.
We're going to talk a little bit about DUI law and how that is a super hot topic this month specifically.
Yes.
I know that there are a lot of police officers out there working the beats hard. And then our last guest today is
Shannon.
And Shannon.
Shannon Rowland with Franklin Burns PC.
And Shannon works for one of the longest kind of lasting and most prominent workers' compensation firms. And hopefully, Shannon, you'll be able to answer a whole bunch of questions about how and why workers' compensation is different from when you just hear personal injury lawyer or something like that. It really is a separate and distinct category of the law.
Yeah. And I have to mention my sponsors.
Absolutely.
I'll start off actually with 3A Law Practice Management. They're a great sponsor and have been a great support of the show. And they have their link and their website on my website, which is atlantalegalexperts.com. And then we have Peachtree Offices, which we are sitting here today in our Peachtree Offices studio.
And I'm going to just say Peachtree Offices, I know people have heard me mention it before. Peachtree Offices was integral to the success of my firm. When I left working for the state back in 2007, I needed a spot where I could just kind of land, turn a key, and run an office. Mm-hmm. I didn't have time to deal with all of the back office issues, making sure the internet works, making sure the mail was set up, making sure there was someone to answer my phones. And that's where Peachtree Offices really came in and saved my rear end. We'd gone from a solo practitioner when I was sitting on my porch. Now we have 3 full-time partners. We litigate significant cases all across the state, and our back office support is still centered around the family that runs Peachtree Offices. They have been a fantastic resource for Chanko Schiffer, along with numerous other law firms that are located in their different buildings. They've got locations Midtown, Downtown, Buckhead, North Fulton County. They're really everywhere.
Yep, we sure are.
And will you tell us a little bit more about 3A?
Yes, just a little bit more about 3A. Their website is 3alawmanagement.com, and they actually help the smaller attorney with the background work, like kind of like Peachtree Offices does. They make their systems a little bit easier so that they can focus, so that the lawyers can focus on what they do. So he has quick and easy, simplistic systems in place for these small firms to adapt, and it helps them to focus on the law and grow their practice. So
I work with a lot of different alumni groups, and I'm a proud graduate of Georgia State College of Law. They don't teach you how to run a law firm when you're in law school.
Right.
They don't spend 2 minutes on how to actually run a business.
Right.
You're concentrating on learning the law. It is so wonderful to walk out and start a business and have these kind of support structures so you don't have to reinvent the wheel. And that's exactly what 3A does for a number of clients.
And Alvaro Arouse is the owner of that.
Absolutely. And he's a great guy. I've known him for several years. They really do some fantastic work at making you as a small business practitioner more successful.
Mm-hmm.
The more successful you are as an independent lawyer and small business person, the better you are for your clients.
Absolutely.
Speaking of clients, let's move on if you're ready. Let's talk to Sean Ditzel. Sorry, I apologize for that. Sean, will you give just a kind of 30-second introduction of who you are, and then we're going to talk about father's rights, which I know is a big chunk of your practice.
Absolutely, Josh. I am Sean Ditzel. I work for Kessler & Solimiani downtown. We're a family law firm, practice throughout the state of Georgia. I've been practicing law for about 8 years, the last six of which have been for Randy Kessler. I do not just father's rights, but we do divorce, adoption, custody, prenups, full gamut of family law.
A lot of people might have heard Mr. Kessler's name, and I'll call him Mr. Kessler because he's a pretty important big dog out there. Give me just a hint for those of people who are unfamiliar with his practice, exactly what he's well known for, and then let's talk a little bit about your individual practice.
Sure. Well, Mr. Kessler, I'll be respectful as well, and he won't mind if I call him Randy, and I believe he's planning to be a guest on this show as well in the future. Mm-hmm. Mr. Kessler has built up his practice over the last 25 years, and he primarily focuses on high net worth, high profile individuals, a lot of athletes, a lot of local celebrities, a lot of non-local celebrities. And so when he is practicing law and not rainmaking, he focuses his practice on that. I work on a lot of those cases with him. However, about 70% of my practice is just my own, you know, sort of middle income, regular divorce clients.
I'll say from a professional perspective, if you go to many CLEs that touch on family law, you're going to run into something that Randy's taught you. He really is one of those driving forces in the Georgia family law universe. He produces a tremendous amount of written material and guidance at a very, very high level, and that's great for your clients to be exposed in that. Let's talk about this season and how family law really intersects with the holidays. You do a good portion of your practice is dedicated to father's rights, but not necessarily just father's rights. You work with mothers, you work with children, you work with the whole spectrum of family law, including also legitimation, and I know we want to talk about that for a minute. What are some of the projects that you are personally interested in, and what do you get out of practicing family law?
Well, I've got into family law originally, and it's kept my interest because I really do love the client contact, working with real people. Some people love working with corporations and the people inside of those corporations. Call me sick. I love the drama, and I love helping people through it and to the other side of it. So especially during the holidays or the holiday season, we see quite a bit of it, and I'm happy to talk about, you know, what particularly we see, but that's why I got into it, and that's why I continue to do it.
Well, why don't you give the listeners some examples of when is the right time to bring in a family law attorney? I am asked by clients fairly routinely, when do I need to go get that professional assistance? And oftentimes we find they've waited a little bit too long.
Right. Well, there are several different types of cases that we deal with. If it's a divorce, you know, we really tell the clients it's up to your own comfort level. We can't tell you when's the right time to be divorced. But if that divorce or if it's a non-divorce that just deals with custody issues, you know, the sooner the better, especially for fathers in Georgia. Georgia is a very unique state in that unless the child is born during a marriage, the father has absolutely no rights to the child, legal rights to the child, unless and until that father is a legitimated father. And so you have to go through the court system. You have to file a legitimation action. You have to get your legal rights established. It doesn't just happen when you put your name on the birth certificate. So I think it's very important for fathers in this state to understand that, you know, you want visitation, you want, you know, rights to go to the school, you want, you know, rights to medical records, you have to go through the court system to get a legitimation. Some people might not say that's right. Some people might say Georgia is behind the times and backwards, but, you know, that's what it is. And we deal with legitimation and custody cases quite often. And particularly when there's issues, you know, like there are in the holidays, I want to see my kid. Well, if the mother is refusing that and you haven't legitimated, you don't really have the rights to do that until you go hire an attorney.
And that legitimation oftentimes pops up at the worst possible moment when you're dealing with a child who is hurt or injured in a medical context or in an educational context, because a parent wants to go out and speak on behalf, advocate for their child, and then suddenly they're silenced because they don't have that legitimation set up.
Right, Josh. I mean, that's absolutely true, and that's why it's vitally important that if you have a child out of wedlock, the first thing you should do is try to get that child legitimated. And typically, it benefits the mothers too, unless she's going to object to you being involved in the child's life at all. And there's a very high standard to establish that. But the mothers like to have the child, have a legitimate father on the record as well, and have that second parent help. And without the legitimation papers, that second parent really can't help in many contexts.
I wanted to ask you, coming to the subject of child support. So you're talking about, if these moms, could cut off the dad, but then what if they want child support? It's like, can you expand on that a little bit?
I certainly can. And this is an issue that we deal with at consultations quite often. A child who hasn't been legitimated, the mother is still entitled to receive child support for that child. So we can have a father who has gone a year and a half, 2 years, however long, and hasn't formally established his legal rights. But if he knows of the child, he does have a legal obligation. He may have no legal rights to the child. He does have a legal obligation to still pay support. And if the mother files for paternity to establish that and to establish child support, it's often the case that the legitimation will go with that. But the courts can order retroactive child support if it hasn't been being paid.
Gotcha. And I was one of those people that were saying that's not fair.
It may not be fair again, but
That's
how it is.
So you have to do your best to work with what the law is. And
absolutely. And courts are generally understanding. If the father had no idea that this child was alive and the mother knew who the father was and just, sort of springs an action on him 3-4 years down the road, maybe that retroactive child supporter is not going to be completely, every penny needs to be accounted for.
Sure.
But if the father knows about a child, doesn't take the time to legitimate, doesn't see the child, and then mom 3-5 years down the road says, hey, I've been doing everything, oftentimes the court will make the father pay commensurate with his income over the last few years.
Now, is it a long and grueling process to be legitimized, or is it pretty simple, or is it based on each case?
It really is based on each case. Gotcha. I mean, a lot of times, as I was saying earlier, it's based on consent and both parents agree. Even if it's usually a legitimation action is usually also in the context of a custody case. So while we can continue to fight about the rights and how much visitation each parent is going to get, how much support is going to be paid, the legitimation piece of it is typically very quickly done.
Okay.
Because the standard is very high for a court to say that child should not have a legitimate father.
Right.
And a legitimation process will also prevent, we see it on kind of the angry end, the abandonment of a minor child charge in the state of Georgia. Georgia is one of the states where you can actually be criminally accused of violating the law for not paying for your child. And a legitimation is an excellent defense to that failure to pay or failure to take consideration for your child, correct?
That's correct, Josh. I couldn't have said that better myself. You sound like an expert on family law.
I stay 100% away from divorce and family law. That is something that I do not. I'll keep him out of jail for the family violence now. But
so you probably work a lot with family, with criminal attorneys and probably personal injury. And ahead and tell me a couple of attorneys that are good referral sources for you.
Well, for criminal defense matters, my gentleman sitting to my right here, David Willingham, I believe he's the best of the best. But no, we do deal with many other facets of the law. We only do exclusively family law at Kessler and Solomiani, so we have a great referral base. We have several attorneys who formerly worked for us. There's PI attorney Darren Tobin in Buckhead, and Darren would be a great guest for the show.
I know. I keep asking him. He needs to get on here.
we're building.
Yeah.
Well, listen, speaking of David, And we're going to come back, I think, at the end of the show and have kind of an open table, roundtable discussion.
If we have time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Let's get over to...
Well, first we need to find out how the listeners can get in touch with Mr. Ditzel.
Absolutely. Sean?
Okay, well, my email address is sditzel@ksfamilylaw.com, KS as in Kessler and Solomiani. My phone number, if people still use that old antiquated technology, is 404-688-6157. I am on social media, not hard to find, at Twitter, @RealSeanDitzel. I don't use Twitter a lot, but I will answer direct messages.
Okay.
Is there a fake Sean out there?
Well, there might
that's
be.
That's pretty cool. I just got to tell you, the real Sean is pretty cool.
I did it, you know, as a preventative measure.
There you go. Case. You got to shoot for the stars. Sean, you mentioned David Willingham. I've known David for several years. We travel in some of the same circles. I've seen him be an incredibly effective litigator in the state and superior courts of, let's see, Cobb County. I've seen you. I've seen you out in Gwinnett County. I've seen you in Fulton County. I think I might have even seen you in Douglas County. You kind of go all over because you're a true private advocate for people that are wrongfully accused and people that need legal assistance.
Have briefcase. We'll travel. I have a case in Savannah right now.
Absolutely. David, will you tell everybody a little bit about what your practice entails, what your biggest focuses are?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you all for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And my primary focus is criminal defense in Georgia, primarily DUI defense. It's about 80% of my practice. And a little bit of my background is that I started out of law school working for a very prominent DUI defense lawyer in the Marietta area who's now a Superior Court judge. And after he became a judge, I practiced for a little while longer at that firm, and then I was recruited by the Cobb County District Attorney's Office, where I was a felony prosecutor for a little over 2 years.
And that was under Pat Head, or was that under...
That's correct. Well, I worked for Pat Head, as well as Vic Reynolds, who's the current elect DA for Cobb County. And about a year and a couple of months ago, I decided to take that leap and open up my own law firm, and I'm situated right in downtown Marietta on the square, and that's where my office is, and it's Willingham Law Firm. And like I said, we focus primarily on DUI defense all over the state of Georgia, but mostly in the metro Atlanta area with a strong emphasis on Cobb County.
Now, why does a client really want to go when they're presented with a DUI issue, retain a DUI specialist? I get asked this all the time and try to sum it up with, you know, DUIs are different. Tell us why DUIs are different.
DUIs are very technical. Most people don't realize that. What I tell people very often is, the license issues with respect to your driving privileges can sometimes be as complicated as a murder case for a lawyer to handle, and that's no exaggeration. For instance, the rules and regulations surrounding what the Department of Driver Services can and can't do to your license right when you're arrested for a DUI is very complex, and if you try to go at it alone, you're not going to fare very well.
I think a lot of people don't understand that it really is a two-track issue.
It is.
There's a criminal process, which is actually the DUI, but then there's this whole license, which is a quasi-civil criminal. It's kind of a mashup, and the police are heavily involved in determining what goes on with your license.
What happens is when you are arrested for a DUI in Georgia, Georgia law says that an officer shall seize your driver's license and initiate what is essentially a civil case between the Department of Driver Services and the arrestee. And when someone's arrested for DUI, they may go online and Google, you know, popular search terms and what do I need to do, and they see this mention of 10 business days or a 10-day letter. You only have 10 days to act. What that means is if you don't file an official appeal with the Department of Driver Services of the officer's decision to seize your license within 10 business days, there's an automatic suspension that goes into effect about 30 days after your arrest, before you've even gone to court on the criminal case, and that's adjudicated. Mind you, you're still presumed innocent of the criminal charges, but this is a civil case, and the officer, through the Department of Driver Services, can suspend your license at the outset of your case.
I know people are really surprised, people that are not associated with the criminal process, at how quickly the state can move to take your driver's license.
They can.
And how much they want you to make big decisions about your future before you've even had an opportunity to review the evidence.
And speaking of big decisions, the question I get most often at cocktail parties and from family and friends is, well, what do I do on the side of the road? Should I blow? Should I do the field sobriety test? And whether you do the state-administered chemical test of your blood, breath, urine, or other bodily substance, is determinative in how long that civil suspension can be at the very outset of your case. If you refuse a breath test, it's kind of like a catch-22, because if you don't give one, you are taking one important piece of evidence away from the state that they can use against you to prove your case beyond a reasonable doubt. But at the same time, if you don't follow those procedures at the beginning of a case, like you don't file that appeal within 10 business days, which, by the way, you should have a lawyer do that, there's an automatic one-year license suspension with no driving privileges whatsoever.
And that's a hard suspension.
And we call that a hard suspension because you can't drive at all. You can't go to Kroger. You can't go to the movies. You can't take your mama to the doctor. You can't do anything. And that's why it's so important to choose the right attorney who knows what they're doing that can review your case under the proverbial microscope and find whatever issues there may be with the case.
And there are a lot of issues associated with DUI that are much more complex than the standard, you know, drug possession case or, you know, battery issue. Will you talk a little bit about the importance of drug recognition, alcohol recognition issues, and what DREs are? I know that you've gone and gotten some of the most advanced certifications out there.
Right.
Will you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I've been trained in field sobriety evaluations. I can administer them. And what I like to tell people is where that benefits my clients is I can Monday morning quarterback that police officer, because everything that happened during the arrest should be on video. When the blue lights go on a police car, the video equipment is triggered. And so what the attorney does is look at the video to spot the issues with the administration of those evaluations. Now, Cobb County, for instance, and many counties are like this, they have what we call DUI task forces, where they have specialized officers who are specially trained in field sobriety evaluations and other DUI detection methods. And, you know, some of these units also have what you just mentioned are drug recognition experts. And those are officers who are further specially trained to detect when someone may be under the influence of a substance other than alcohol, such as marijuana or cocaine or some sort of methamphetamine. And go ahead.
And that's a big topic these days. I know Cobb County, along with Gwinnett County, has been much more aggressive recently.
They are aggressive.
With these non-alcohol inebriation and driving under the influence cases.
Well, where it's going to become a bigger and bigger issue is in the field of marijuana. About 15 years ago, the state of Georgia said that it's no longer constitutional to criminalize simply having marijuana in your system. Because as we all know, marijuana is starting to become legal in more and more places. So now the standard for marijuana is they have to prove that marijuana made you a less safe driver. In other words, they have to prove the effect it had on your body. And that charge is kind of like putting the pieces of a puzzle together. They have to circumstantially prove that marijuana was in your system and that it rendered you less safe to be behind the wheel. And that's where drug recognition expertise comes in, where an officer has further field sobriety evaluations he can do. It's kind of a fishing expedition because you really don't know this person. You don't know what their body's like, what their reaction is to certain substances. And so you need an attorney to really look at what that officer did to vet their investigation and see how valid it really was.
And I think we jumped over something that's really important. I want to make sure we step back and see it. There are two different really kinds of DUIs in the state of Georgia.
That's right.
There's a per se DUI, which means there's some sort of test. And then there's the less safe. Could you talk a little bit about the difference between those?
Right. Well, it's kind of like two alternative routes of getting to the same place. It's two theories of the same type of criminal charge, and they merge for sentencing purposes. With DUI per se, I call that the magic number DUI. All the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt is that you were driving a car, the car was moving, and that within 3 hours of your driving ending, your blood alcohol concentration was 0.08 grams or more. That's it. Doesn't matter how much alcohol you had, you know, whether you're male or female, what your water composition is like in your body. It's just the state hitting that magic number, and they hit that magic number with an official state chemical test of your blood, breath, urine, or other bodily substance. They can even take a hair follicle.
And this is a really complicated chemical test.
And this is where DUI cases really grow legs, because it starts out as a traffic stop type case, and then all of a sudden it becomes completely about something else, which is science. And that's where you need an attorney that's been trained in all that science, that knows how to pick it apart and find the issues. Now, very quickly, with respect to the other type of DUI, in that type of DUI, less safe, the state must show beyond a reasonable doubt that alcohol or some other substance, it can't even be over-the-counter medications, rendered you, quote-unquote, less safe to be driving. And there's a legal definition of that. And whether they can prove that depends on the evidence, and it really depends on whether the state can put those pieces of the puzzle together all the way down to what the person's eyes look like, was their speech slurred, how are they behaving on the video. And you kind of use your common sense when you're evaluating a case to advise a client, hey, the case is strong against you, or it's weak, or this is what I think your options are. But the state has those two tools to come at you with on any given DUI case.
So we get down to it, and we're at a holiday party, and we're having fun, and we don't realize we've probably had just a little bit too much, and we get pulled over. Do we take the test? That's the big question.
Well, I know. That's the question I get most often. There's really no right or wrong answer, but I'll say this. If you give a test, regardless of what the result is, you are supplying the government with evidence to be used against you in a court of law.
Okay.
And they don't have to read you Miranda before you give that test. They read what's called an implied consent notice. It's a little orange card. And at the end of that orange card, they ask you, will you submit to the official state chemical test of your breath under the applied consent law or whatever test they designate? And that's all they have to do. But it's a catch-22 in the sense that the officer on scene doesn't have to give you legal advice, but he does have to tell you by law that if you don't give a test, your license will be suspended for a year. And at the same time, that goes back to that civil case we were talking about.
Right.
But at the same time, if you blow, you know, you may not give too good of a result, and it may be bad for your case. But generally speaking, when people ask me for friendly advice, I say, look, the less you do and the less you say, the better off you're going to be. And it sounds kind of cliche, but it's true. You're not going to beat the ride that night. You may go to jail for DUI, but the less you do and the less you say, the more likely it is you're going to beat the rap.
Okay. So then you go and get an attorney.
Right.
You.
The best cases I get that come across my desk are the ones where the person didn't do any field sobriety evaluations, or they did them and they looked good, or the officer made some mistakes and they didn't give a breath test. Because like he was saying, there are two types of DUI. With DUI per se, they have to get to that magic number. And if they don't have a chemical test, they can't get to that magic number, and they can't prove that count. So they're left with one of the two types of DUI, and that's where, you know, it really starts getting fun and competitive, and that's where I live, is trying DUI cases.
Right, right.
And talk a little bit about why it's important with contested DUIs to have somebody that, you know, not to be rude, actually knows what they're doing.
Well, in my experience, and I've been very fortunate to have a good track record at jury trials, I learned a lot about trying cases, not only from my prior experience as a defense lawyer, but also as a felony prosecutor, trying everything from shoplifting and simple drug cases all the way up to murder cases for Cobb County. You know, when you out-prepare and outwork the other side, good things happen. What I tell potential clients is my methodology is no stone unturned. If there's an issue with the case, I'm going to find it, and we're going to make hay out of it. But if there's nothing to work with, I'm going to tell you that too. We're still going to get you a good result. But it's important to have an attorney with a reputation for winning trials, because the prosecutors know the attorneys. And I speak as a prior prosecutor when I say this. Prosecutors know the attorneys who are going to make them work and that they may lose against. And those attorneys are going to get the better plea offers and the better treatment in court, and their clients are going to fare better.
I hear a lot of times from clients that they don't need a lawyer because it's just their first DUI. Now, I laugh at that because I know the state's tricks, but tell people why it's so important to fight that first DUI.
Well, and again, some of this is online, but people don't understand, generally speaking, you know, what the punishment is for a first DUI in Georgia. Technically, the law says you got to go back to jail for anywhere between 24 hours and 10 days if you're convicted. You have to be on probation for a year, and it can't end early if you're convicted. You have to do 40 hours of community service, sometimes more if there are aggravating circumstances. You have to have a drug and alcohol evaluation to make sure you don't have a substance abuse problem. In other words, you got to get a clean bill of health. You have to do DUI school, which is about $300 and takes about 3 days. And then finally, there is another, and by the way, you got to pay a fine too, but there's another license suspension associated with the criminal conviction that is 4 months. Now, you can get a permit during those 4 months if you've never had a DUI before, but it is a very limited permit. You can go to and from work and for work-related purposes, but that's about it. What I tell people all the time is, you can't go to Kroger. You can't go to the movies. It really is a limited work permit. And all of those things are going to be on your back if you're convicted of DUI. And it can be very cumbersome and burdensome, and it costs a lot of money. So it behooves people to hire the right attorney to fight this charge, because they don't have the training and experience to spot the issues that may get them out of it or exonerate them if they truly weren't less safe to be behind the wheel. It's not illegal to have a drink and get behind the wheel. What's illegal is to have too much.
I always tell people that if it was illegal to drink and drive in Georgia, the Braves would be out of business. Every restaurant in Buckhead would be out of business.
That's true.
It'd be a tough world out there. And this less safe burden really is a complicated nexus.
It is.
It's a police officer's observation combined with the argument of the state versus the arguments of an individual who is just going about their day and their own personal knowledge about their own body and their own physiology.
Right.
Will you talk just for a few minutes on there's a hot topic coming out right now, which is the Intoxilizer 5000 and 9000. This may appeal a little bit more to our sophisticated listeners who know a little bit about DUI law. Will you give us just a glimpse of what's going on with those two issues and those two machines?
Sure. Well, very briefly, the GBI has been tasked with determining which device will be the official state breath test in Georgia for determining if somebody's over our legal limit or at that magic number. And their Division of Forensic Sciences has always used what's called an intoxilizer breath testing device, and that's manufactured by a company called CMI out of Kentucky. Now, they have many models of that device, but one of them is called the Intoxilizer 5000, and that machine has been used for years and years and years in Georgia. And if you look at the bottom of the little printout that it gives, it says, like, you know, copyright 1983, and I always point at that potential clients and say, do you still play, you know, your Atari video game machine? Would you really trust this? But to hit at what you're talking about, a couple of years ago, Georgia decided to upgrade to the 9000 model, and that will go into effect across the state by the end of next year, 2015. And we're already seeing law enforcement agencies phase into that machine. It is better technology. It's more reliable technology, but it's still not as good as blood testing. It's still a breath estimate of where somebody is at as far as their BAC. But that machine is going to be the subject of ongoing litigation in the near future. And it makes it all the more important that you hire a good attorney who knows the right expert witnesses to talk to about that device so you find any and all issues with it.
Because this law is literally evolving on a month-to-month
basis.
It is.
I mean, I get new clients coming in every week, and some of them have blown into the Intox 5000, and more of them are blowing into the 9000. They bring their printout from their arrest, you know, I can't speak for all the law enforcement agencies, but I can say that by Georgia law, by December 2015, they are required to all use the 9000. So it's an issue of funding and availability and things like that. But those two devices are quite different, and that makes a big difference in the case.
David, again, and we're going to come back to a group discussion at the end. How are people going to find you and reach out to you?
Well, like I said, I'm situated in downtown Marietta. It's Willingham Law Firm, but I practice all over the state of Georgia. My office number is 678-984-3357, and my website is simply davidwillingham.com, and it's Willingham Law Firm, and I'm available 24/7 because a lot of my potential clients are, you know, having issues late at night, so I'm always available.
And I know that you're also a big personal customer service. You're not one of these giant law firms with a million associates.
No.
You actually litigate your cases in court. I'll testify to that personally.
Yeah.
I see you out there in the front lines on a regular basis. You're in the mix.
Yeah, and I have fun doing it. It's what I really enjoy doing. So,
David, thank you so much. And,
thank you.
We're going to move on to our last guest, and then I think we're just going to open it up.
Yeah, yeah. So we have Shannon Rowland here. Good morning.
Good morning.
You for being so quiet and patient. It's been a great show so far. And she is with J. Franklin Burns, PC, as Josh said, a very big firm here in Atlanta. And she is a native of Metro Atlanta, and she joined J. Franklin Burns, PC in 2007 after working for another plaintiff's firm in Decatur. She was born and raised here in Atlanta. She received a B.S. in psychology from the Kennesaw State College in 94 and a Juris Doctor from Georgia State University College of Law in 98. While in law school, Ms. Rowland received the Cali Award for Advanced Criminal Litigation. She was also the chairwoman for the Association of Women Law Students and a member of Moot Court. Her experience in workers' comp began while she was still in law school, when she clerked for a semester for the Chief Judge of the Georgia Court of Appeals, the Honorable Dorothy Toth Beasley. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You did.
Good. She's been practicing law since 98 and has 17 years of experience exclusively in the field of workers' comp. So tell me a little more about workers' comp. Let's educate our listeners.
Well, it's a very specialized area of law, and a lot of people think that it's similar to personal injury, and it's just not.
Okay.
If you go into a workers' comp situation and you think, oh, great, I'm going to get millions of dollars. Well, you're not going to get that. And if you learn that early on in the claim, you'll do a lot better with accepting the limitations within the system. If you do get millions of dollars from a workers' compensation claim, you will not have the physical ability to enjoy to spend that money. You're going to be hooked up to machines, paralyzed, 24-hour nursing care. It's not going to be something where those millions of dollars are ever going to make you whole again. The big thing most people misunderstand about workers' comp is they assume that it comes with pain and suffering and punitive damages, so that you get millions and millions of dollars just because you got hurt. And the law in Georgia has never allowed workers' compensation claims to have pain and suffering or punitive damage recovery. Although you do have a lot of pain and suffering, mm-hmm. you do not get a financial payout for that. And once people accept that, it makes my job a whole lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people will not accept that, though. They do not believe that you don't get those benefits. And unfortunately, you just don't. It's never been available in Georgia, and it never will be. So once you accept that, the whole process of understanding what happens when you're injured on the job is a whole lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
There is a limitation to how long they pay you. It's anywhere from 350 to 400 weeks from your date of accident, which is like 6.7 to 7.6 years.
Wow.
That doesn't guarantee you're going to get a check on a weekly basis for that long, but it's just representative of how long those financial weekly benefits are available.
Gotcha.
And you only get those when you're not able to work. A lot of people think, well, I'm in pain, so I shouldn't have to work. And I would agree with that. When I'm hurting, I don't really want to work either. But you just don't get to say, hey, I don't feel well, so I'm going to just stay home. I mean, a lot of people, especially when they're kids, if you don't want to go to school, what is the thing you say to everybody? You say, my stomach hurts. You don't say, I have a fever, because you can see that. You can find that answer out.
Mm-hmm.
But you say, your stomach hurts. And in workers' comp, what a lot of people say is, I don't think I should have to work because I'm in pain. And though I agree with that, you don't get to make that determination. If you take yourself out of work because you're in pain, there's no obligation on the employer or the insurer to pay you.
Gotcha.
If the doctor says you can't work, you can get paid. Or if the doctor limits your ability to work, then it depends on whether you get paid, whether the employer has a job available for you within the restrictions the doctor has given you. And many times the employers do have a job and they claim it's within the restrictions, but many times when the injured worker gets back to work, the employer is saying, well, I don't care what the doctor said about your lifting limitations, you're going to lift that and you're going to do this and you're going to do that. And we run into a lot of problems with return to work because many times the employers are mad at my clients because they got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're costing me money because you've placed a claim against my insurance company. Or, you know, we had so many days without an accident and we were bragging about that. And then, you know, you went and got your leg cut off. So we're mad at you. And I mean, you laugh, but it's true.
Yeah,
they take it very personal. A lot of times my clients take it personal, too. I mean, the employer treated them great until they got hurt on the job. And now the employer is looking for any reason to get rid of them.
Right.
And it's not fair. And I'm going to go ahead and tell you the system's not fair. But there's a lot of good things about the system, too.
Tell me some.
Well, one of the good things is you have the right to change doctors if you don't like the doctor you're seeing. Unfortunately, they do give a list of doctors, and since they're paying the bills, usually they get to control the medical. And there's some times where you can change doctors and look to someone else. A lot of times they have excellent doctors on their lists. And all you got to do is look at the list. If you have a hand injury, you don't pick a family doctor usually. You pick right. someone who has that specialty. Sometimes you need a specialty that's not on their list. Mm-hmm. And then you can go outside the list, and they should accommodate you in that.
That's good.
If you get with a doctor who thinks you're, I mean, I call it faking the funk. You're exaggerating. You're manipulating your injuries for financial gain. And we know you have a broken arm. We're going to get you into someone else who is not going to look at you wanting to milk the system. They're going to look and see what's wrong with you, what can be done to make you better, and if we can, get you back to work. Because that's what the goal of the system is to provide you relief, restore you to suitable employment, if at all possible.
Sure.
So what you're telling our listeners is that if you're injured on the job, you're not necessarily allowed to just use your general practitioner.
That's absolutely right. Now, sometimes they'll deny your claim. And when they deny your claim, they don't get to tell you who to go see. They lose control of the medical. The downside of that is if they deny your claim, you're having to fight by hiring a professional. And you do need to hire a professional. It should be me. But if it's not, you need to hire someone who knows what workers' comp is all about. Because the insurance company, when they deny your claim, they usually have already spoken to their lawyers about it. They already have legal advice on what to do, or they should at least. And so if you're going to go against that ruling, they say, we're not going to pay for you, you need to hire a lawyer to help you, because if you try to file the claim on your own, you're going to be battling lawyers on right. the other side. Right.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because I know that our office is approached by people saying, why should I get a lawyer? My company's just going to take care of me. I kind of know where this story goes, but tell people what happens when you take that attitude.
You're presuming that your company has any say-so in what the insurance company is going to do with your claim. Sometimes they do. If they're a big enough company, they have paid for the right to get to dictate what happens to you. A lot of times, though, especially smaller employers, they buy a basic workers' comp policy that gives them no right to say anything about your claim. And so when that happens, the insurance company can make a stupid decision or a foolish decision, which they do frequently. Mm-hmm. Fortunately for me, they do that. Unfortunately for my clients, because it leads them to have to hire a lawyer in situations where maybe they shouldn't. But if you're going to presume your employer is going to take care of you, you're going to also have to presume that the insurance company is going to look out for your best interest. And they're not. They're going to look out for, how can we do this? How can we fix you the cheapest with a doctor who's going to say what we want them to say and get you back to work so we don't have to keep paying you?
Right. And I think a lot of people don't understand this relationship between the treating doctors and these insurance companies. These aren't just doctors like your regular general practitioner, somebody associated with a hospital. These are doctors where 90%, 95% of their business is all work-related injuries out of these workers' compensation cases. What kind of problems does that bring up?
It brings up a whole lot of problems. You're absolutely right. Many of the times, their list of doctors, we call it a panel of physicians, and usually it's six or more different doctors, an eye specialist or clinics, because usually when you're first injured, you can go to the hospital or an urgent care center, depending mm-hmm. on the severity of your injury, and you can get that first immediate care. Emergency situations, you should always just go to the emergency room. That way, a doctor there, if you need surgery or if it's broken bones or a head injury, you can have the specialist at the hospital take a look at you immediately. But once you get out of there, they want you to have something called an authorized treating physician. And they want it from their list of doctors. And I can assure you that their list of doctors is going to be doctors that probably are good surgeons and probably outside of workers' comp are pretty decent. But they have an opinion about workers' comp, and their opinion is usually employer-insurer related, which is not in my client's best interest most of the time, unfortunately. And so if you're going to be selecting a doctor, you're going to select a doctor, and you're going to presume this doctor is looking out for you, which is their job, the Hippocratic Oath.
Right.
That's their job. But in reality, in the background, the insurance company is, the adjuster is going to be emailing the doctor or calling the doctor or assigning a nurse to go there and speak with them. And they're going to get the information. And I've caught a lot of, I like nurses on files for especially complicated medical treatment, more than one body part involved. But sometimes those nurses that the insurance companies appoint are going in there saying, hey, doctor, what's wrong with this guy? Can he go back to work? Can he go back to work? Can he go back to work? And right. That's all they're focusing on. They're not focusing on taking care of my client's needs, which could be having physical therapy. It could be medications. It could be testing. There's a lot of things. But some of these doctors will not take that extra step and say, okay, my client is saying my back hurts. They right. go to the doctor. My back hurts. 6 months later, my back still hurts. It's not unreasonable at that point to order an MRI or something like that. And it's not that expensive. Workers' comp can cost a lot of money in medical, but they pay at a discount. So an MRI might cost $500. Hmm. And it's worth $500 to find out if there's a herniated disc causing all the symptoms my client is saying.
Right.
I've had many of times where the insurance company doctor said there's nothing wrong with my client. And they go and get this MRI. And I actually tried a case like this many years ago. Their doctor said my client was faking and exaggerating. We went to trial. Thank God I won. And, of course, the judge orders my client to go back to this doctor for an evaluation who orders an MRI at this time. And my alleged faking client had two herniated discs in his neck, and that wow. same doctor performed a two-level fusion.
Wow.
You mentioned actually going to trial on a workers' comp case, and a lot of people don't understand that trial really is a good option for some of these cases. And a lot of people don't think that you try workers' comp. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, let me give you a little background on the workers' comp system. Like, I have been in Superior Court before, and I've been to the Court of Appeals a couple of times, but our cases don't start out there. They start out in an administrative process. We have an administrative law judge. We have our own separate little court system, and we try cases all over the state of Georgia. And I've tried several throughout my lifetime, some years way more than others, but one of the reasons to go to court is to resolve an issue that the insurance company is not willing to show any flexibility with. Okay. I say insurance company. Sometimes it's a self-insured employer, and so you're really fighting the bigger giants out there. Right. But many times you're dealing with an insurance company, and they've made a decision, and they've given their lawyer the marching orders, and they won't back off. So sometimes we could go to trial for approval of a surgery, for example. I did that a couple of years ago. They would not approve a surgery. They sent my guy for a second opinion. The second opinion doctor said, we need a new MRI. That's a terrible MRI. The new MRI showed exactly the same herniations as the first one. They still wouldn't approve the surgery. We had to go to court to get the surgery approved, and we were successful in doing that. Sometimes you're going to court to just prove that the claim should be accepted in the first place.
Wow.
And on some cases, you could go to court multiple times over many different issues. Because in our situation, going to court isn't always the final say. It's to resolve whatever issue is pending.
Right.
The final say for us could be a settlement or a judge ruling against the injured worker in some capacity. That's where we differ with personal injury claims. When you go to court on a personal injury claim and the jury renders the verdict, that's, unless there's appeal involved, that's usually it. Not for our cases. Our cases, we could go to court multiple times over different issues depending on what the problems are.
Now, you will, though, work hand in hand with a personal injury lawyer, because sometimes these cases involve a personal injury component.
They sure do. We've had several cases where they've involved car wrecks on the job, where the person has to travel for work, and they could cause the wreck, which would lead them to have to file a claim against their own insurance company, and someone might sue them. But there's the workers' comp component to there as well. There's also many times where my clients are just driving and another vehicle hits them. And so they have two claims. And in workers' comp, if they accept responsibility on that personal injury claim, they have a right to do something called subrogation. And that would be, they want their money back. They shouldn't have to pay out because someone else hurt my client. And there's a lot involved with that. They have to prove that my client's been fully and completely compensated by whatever that personal injury settlement is, and so that they could get their money back. And that's a very hard burden to meet, depending on the severity of the person's injuries.
But it's really important, because in order to make a client truly whole again, sometimes you have to pursue both a workers' comp and a personal injury.
Absolutely, especially because workers' comp doesn't have that pain and suffering and punitive damages aspect. The personal injury claim, they may make a whole lot more money through a settlement off that.
I was about to ask that. Is that when you get the millions?
Well, if I'm the one with a personal injury claim representation, yes.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's some colleagues have had the personal injury case to begin with, and they refer the comp aspect to our office.
Sure.
Will you talk a little bit about how J. Frank Burns has been around this town for a while? He is a well-known practitioner. I've seen him speak before. Tell us a little bit about the firm.
Well, many years ago, Frank and some of the other lawyers in our office, myself included, we all were defense lawyers. In fact, how I met Frank is, I guess I could say this now because I don't work for Drew Eckel and Farnham anymore, but when I did work for them, Frank was trying to lure me away and interviewed me to be a defense lawyer with him. And then he decided I think it's been 13, maybe 14 years ago, to become a claimant's lawyer. That's what we call our injured workers. We're not plaintiff's lawyers. We're claimant's lawyers. And so he started off on his own. He was sharing office space with another well-known law firm, Slappy and Sad. You probably know them as well. And he was just doing workers' comp out there, and he got really big. He's very good at marketing and networking. And then he ended up hiring a couple of lawyers, and I just lucked out. I was looking for a job, and he
picked the right
me.
One for sure.
Well, I would like to think so, but I am very appreciative of him hiring me when he did. There's a whole new story to that, but I mean, he hired me at a time that I was looking for a job, and he was in desperate need of additional help, and it's been great for me.
That's and I wonderful. Know Frank is big on networking among other lawyers. You guys rely extensively on other lawyers in the community for referrals. Will you talk a little bit about what your ideal client is and how your working relationship with other lawyers in the community works?
Sure. There's a lot of times where we don't get a lot of referrals from like divorce or criminal attorneys. Usually we're the ones referring out to them. Unfortunately, our clients sometimes go through some pretty rough patches when they're injured on the job. But a lot of times we get referral sources from a wide variety. My former law firm, when I was in Decatur, I worked for Palsy Parker and Associates, and his son Ken has kept on his legacy since he passed away. Ken refers us workers' comp cases. I would refer him personal injury and some bankruptcy cases because he does that. It's important to network with a wide variety of lawyers, and Frank is very good about doing that, and we've tried to keep that up as well. I mean, certainly I am very busy with my caseload, and he's much happier with the networking than I am. It's not that I don't want to network. I don't have time to network. I have over 100 files, and I'm trying to work them as best I can. But one of the things he did, which was really smart business model, is interaction with other lawyers, inviting them. We have a party every August that's pretty big where we interact with lawyers from all over the state of Georgia. Mm-hmm. And that way you build a business model that way where you're not relying solely on social media or internet marketing, though we do that as well. Our website is www.jfblaw.com. J. Franklin Burns is the initials. And so we do a lot of that way. But as far as interacting with other lawyers, you're going to have claims that I'm not going to have, you know, mm-hmm. My clients might have a bankruptcy need, so I'll need a bankruptcy lawyer to refer to. Sometimes bankruptcy lawyers have referred us a workers' comp case because the client is in workers' comp, and there's a lot of interactions between those two courts where my client can't just discharge all his debt in bankruptcy and then make out like a bandit with a workers' comp settlement because our money is tax-free. My money's not, unfortunately. I pay taxes because it is actual income to me, but for my clients, if they got $100,000 after attorney's fees, that's $100,000 tax-free money. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of interactions between other courts. So we've made a really good effort at trying to network with other lawyers so we can make sure that when we're doing something, it's not infringing on the rights and responsibilities they have in other areas.
And what's the phone number and social media contact for y'all?
Sure. It's jfblaw.com is our website. We have a Facebook page. I think it's Frank Burns Law. And at Frank Burns Law, I believe, is our Twitter handle, though most of our clients do not do Twitter, so we're not very active on that.
Right.
But our phone number is 404-303-7770. And if you want to call and speak to me, just ask for Shannon Rowland, and they will send you to me. And I'm very good about returning calls. If you do get my voicemail, I'm on the phone 24/7 pretty much.
Now, we're down to about the last 5 minutes, so I just wanted to open it up. I want to make sure that everybody's had an opportunity to answer and ask any questions they have. Sean, let's get back over to you.
Sure.
Anything more that you think we really need to inform our listeners about? And again, how are people going to get in contact with you? And who are the best referrals for you?
Well, let me start with how people get in contact with me. I think I neglected to list our website. It's www.ksfamilylaw.com. And you can click over to my bio and read more about me. I would say that one of the major issues that I didn't talk about today that I believe is going to be very relevant is in Georgia, people need to understand that conduct is still very relevant for division of assets and also for alimony. So you might hear attorneys say, and you might hear people say, oh, well, judges don't really care about conduct. They don't care about cheating. They don't care about adultery. That it's certainly lesser so now than it was 20, 30, 50 years ago. But that stuff still comes into play, and we make our living making those arguments why someone should get less money in divorce or should get more alimony based on the conduct of another party. So we see a lot of juicy situations, a lot of drama, and it's our job to use that to our advantage. So if an attorney is approaching a case and thinking, well, that doesn't matter, well, that's where we make our bones, coming in and making that matter. So tell your clients or tell your friends and family members to be on their best behavior.
And you get
a
lot of
question for him as well. You're involved in the State Bar in the Young Lawyers Division. Can you talk a little more about that?
I am. I am on the board of directors of the YLD. I still have a couple of years of eligibility left. I have worked my way up. I ran the family law committee for a couple of years, and now I'm the director of law school outreach. So I go to the law schools and I recruit them young and get them involved. I view the bar, the YLD is the philanthropic arm of the bar, and we mm-hmm. do a lot. It's a great way to network. It's a great way to stay involved, and it's a great way to give back. And if there are young lawyers out there listening to this, I would recommend getting involved and just contact me. I have all the proper people to introduce you to.
Gotcha. Awesome.
Great. And David, if you would remind us again how people can get in contact with you and maybe a couple tips for driving around there during this holiday season.
Sure. Well, again, it's davidwillingham.com. And the direct number to me is 678-984-3357. And just some friendly tips for this time of year. You know, if you see a roadblock, and there's going to be more and more roadblocks as we go through the holiday season, it may be worse if you try to avoid it, because surely enough, they've got an officer staked out near the roadblock to see if anybody's trying to dodge it. I've had some new clients recently who tried to do that. So the police are smart, and you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, if you've just had a drink or two, go through the roadblock and be honest with the officer. And like I said, you know, the less you do and the less you say, the better off you'll be. You may be charged, you may take a ride to jail, but if you hire the right attorney, you're going to be just fine. And that's where we come in.
Is there a general rule of thumb? I know it's hard because everybody's different weight, different height.
Right.
You know, is there a general rule of thumb just to stick by when you go to these parties? I know that's
well,
a tough
that's
question.
A great question, because you know, everybody's metabolism is different. It depends on whether you're male or female, your water composition,
can
what type
tell,
of
I
alcohol.
Can you tell I just want to have a drink?
I mean,
I mean, that's really what was behind the question.
The science, the science says that generally speaking, for every drink you have, whether it's a standard, you know, 12-ounce beer or an ounce and a half of liquor or 6 or 7 ounces of wine, that you're going to go up about 0.02 grams BAC per drink, depending on what's in your stomach and, you know, how quickly you drink. So, again, very generally speaking,
okay.
It may take 3 or 4 drinks to get to the legal limit,
right.
But that's different for everybody.
Right.
I think a preconceived notion in the public is that 0.08 is not that intoxicated, but depending on who you are, you may be pretty buzzing at 0.08.
Right, right.
So you just have to know yourself and know your body and use your common sense. I mean, you
gotcha.
Know if you've had too much, but,
sure.
you know, if you refuse that test, the officer's going to arrest you anyway, because although it doesn't sound right, they're going to presume you guilty until proven right. innocent out there on the scene instead of the other way around. Right. And that's what they're going to travel under. And you need the right attorney to get involved in your case to reverse that and show them why they were wrong.
And get that attorney early. The right. earlier you start working with a real bona fide professional like David, the better your results are going to be on the back end.
That's right.
And Shannon, real quick, I know we're running out of time. How do people get in touch with you and Frank for the workers' compensation?
Sure. Our phone number is 404-303-7770. My email is sroland, that's S-R-O-L-E-N, at jfblaw.com. You can go on the website, jfblaw.com as well, and click on my bio. And or Google search my name if you can't remember all that.
Thank you. Thank you, Josh.
Yeah, we're about out of time. Yeah, I'll give you my 30-second plug. Yeah. I'm Josh Schiffer of Chenko Schiffer. We're three guys, and we like practicing law. We've got actually a former Drew Eckel guy who does our personal injury and premises liability. We've got a former solicitor on staff who's also a former police officer, Fulton County DUI prosecutor, that we send to many of the same things David goes to. That'd be Doug Chenko. And my name's Josh Schiffer. I do more domestic violence than I care to shake a stick at, and this is my busy time of year. Be sure to give us a holler at 404-842-0909 if there's anything we can assist with. Emily, last few seconds.
Yeah, so it's Emily Rowell here, and we're going to wrap up the show. Just go to AtlantaLegalExperts.com, and you can see, you will be able to see all of the attorneys on this show and all of their bios and all the links to all their contact information. So happy holidays, and we look forward to seeing you soon.